Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
Do you wish you could read minds? Our guest this hour says we are all mind readers, but we don't always get it right. We'll find out why that is and how we can better understand others as we talk this hour with the author of MindWise. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have had moments of perfect understanding or unfortunate misunderstandings with other people, we'd like to hear from you this hour, as well as your questions for our guest on how we understand. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at Joy Cardine Show or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Nicholas Epley. He is the John Templeton Keller Professor of Behavioral Science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He has published more than 50 articles in 24 journals in his field. He was named a professor to watch by the Financial Times and has won numerous awards for his work. He is the author of MindWise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want. And he joins us from TV House in Chicago. Good morning.
Morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, you start this book by saying that human beings can already read minds. Did you know I was going to ask that first off?
I could have guessed because it was at the beginning of the book. So I had a sense about that, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you mean by us already being mind readers?
Well, so my wife is a little embarrassed when I tell people that I study mind reading, but it's the truth, but it's not the spooky or magical or mystical or new agey variety of reading minds. It's the kind of mind reading we do every 5 minutes of our lives and every social interaction we ever have, or in every social interaction we imagine, where we think about what others might believe or feel, what their intentions might be, what their goals are, what their emotions are. I walked by on the way to the train this morning to come in to do this interview here in Chicago, and some neighbors had plowed their sidewalks and some hadn't, and I wondered, what were the people who hadn't plowed their sidewalks thinking? Were they thinking that I'd come by and have to trudge through the snow this morning? We just do this all the time, so routinely, it's almost like breathing. We hardly even notice that we're doing it.
Yeah, so is it just this gut feeling, or is there evidence that we read minds?
Oh, sure. So you can see this, in fact, in two-year-old infants. So human beings are unique on the planet for a number of reasons, but one of them is that we seem to be the only species that thinks about the minds of others, that thinks about others' goals or motives or intentions. So there was this really ambitious experiment published in Science a few years ago, run in a Max Planck Institute in Germany, where the researchers compared 105 human toddlers against the performance of 106 adult chimpanzees on a variety of different cognitive tests. Some of the tests were reasoning about physical objects, things like the ability to use a tool to solve a problem or the ability to track where a reward was located under a cup. Turns out our two-year-old infants are doing about as well as the adult chimpanzees. They're about equal in terms of their ability to reason about physical objects. But then there were another set of questions, another set of items that were about social objects. So, for instance, you'd see somebody reaching for a cup. Could you infer that the person had the goal of reaching for the cup, that they wanted the cup to get something to drink out of? So they look at the child's behavior. Did they try to complete the other person's goal? They looked at the ability to track a person's eye gaze, which is a way we monitor what other people are thinking, because what you're looking at tends to be an indication of what you're thinking about. And what they found on these social tasks is that our two-year-old infants are crushing the competition on those kinds of tests. So they're getting in the ballpark of 80% correct on these items, whereas the adult chimps are more like 30% correct on these items. Already by 2 years of age, you can see our distinct social advantage already emerging at that point. And that really comes with the ability to think about the minds of others.
Yet, we are often wrong when we are reading other people's minds. What's going on there?
Well, there are a few points to remember. So when you can think about this with a baseball player, right? So if you've got a professional baseball player, they can hit a baseball very well. What do we mean they hit it very well? Well, usually we mean they hit it better than other people. So like our two-year-old infants are better at social reasoning than chimpanzees, so often we make a relative comparison. Sometimes we make an absolute comparison, which means that they can hit the ball at all. So they're better than chance. They're better than zero. So they hit maybe 30% of the time they'll be able to hit the baseball. But there's also another number that you care about when evaluating performance, and that is what would perfection look like? Mm-hmm. Right? So a baseball player who hits 300 is hitting okay, or a baseball player who hits 400, 40% of the time, is doing exceptionally well, but that's not batting 1,000. That's not doing perfectly. And so we have this going on with our ability to think about and understand other people as well. You find over and over again that people are considerably, sometimes hugely better than chance, sometimes less so. We can detect lies, for instance, slightly better than chance. We can guess other people's attitudes at better than chance levels, but it's far from perfect. So that's the gold standard to keep in mind, too. What does perfection look like, and why don't we get there? That's really what the bulk of the book is about.
Yeah. Talk some about this, the study of married couples who had to predict what their spouses or partners were thinking about various topics.
Yeah, so you know you can imagine bringing a baseball player into a stadium and testing his or her ability to hit a baseball. You'd throw the ball player a bunch of pitches and essentially see how they do. Many, many psychologists, including us, have done these kinds of experiments, brought people into a context where you throw them some pitches. Essentially, you ask them questions about what somebody else is thinking, what their emotions are, what their beliefs are, what their attitudes, and we see how well they do compared to some other conditions and compared to some other questions. So the study you're referring to was one where we brought married couples into the Museum of Science and Industry. This is sort of the newlywed game for science, if you will. And we had one person sit in a room and fill out a questionnaire for us. We gave them 20 different questions in this particular experiment. Well, you know, we can switch up those questions. We can ask about different kinds of things. In this study, we asked 20 different questions. They included questions like, or statements like, "I think our family is too heavily in debt today." And you would respond about the extent to which you disagree or agree with that statement on a 1 to 7 scale. So 1 would be strongly agree and 7 would be strongly agree, with 4 being the neutral point. So one person was answering all of these questions about their beliefs. And then we had a spouse in another room predicting what the other person would say. And what we found were a couple of things. So mainly what you do is you then compare accuracy. How many did you predict correctly, for instance? Or what are the correlations between predicted and actual responses? And we found a few things. One thing we found is that our married couples, or some were dating too, they weren't all married, but most were married. We found that the couples could predict the other person's responses at better than chance levels. So you're better than pure guessing. So on this 20-item questionnaire, you would have predicted by chance alone about 3 out of 20 correct, because there are 7 response options. By chance alone, you'd get about 3 out of those 20 correct. Our couples hit the bullseye more than 3 out of 20 times, but not all that much more. They hit the bullseye exactly right 4.9 of 20 times correctly.
And that surprises me. Only five correct answers out of 20.
Yeah, it surprised our married couples too, because when we asked the spouse, the person in the other room, to predict how many they had, to guess how many they had predicted correctly, they didn't say 4.9, they said 12.6. So they had overestimated their accuracy, their ability to predict what their spouse was thinking, by a wide margin. That's the surprising part. It's not the 5 out of 20 figure isn't surprising. Just like I could throw a pitcher, you know, throw a baseball player really hard or really easy pitches, and I would push that number around. I could make it easier. I could make it harder. These were not horribly easy questions. The surprising part is that our couples were, you know, actually hitting a blooper single, but they thought they'd hit a home run. That is, they thought they had really nailed it when in fact they hadn't. And that's the surprising part. That's the thing that runs through all of the research, is that however good we are at detecting whether somebody's lying to us or not, or is what their beliefs or attitudes are, we tend to think we're much better than we actually are.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. You'd think that married couples would know each other better than just five correct answers out of 20.
Well, they do know each other better than strangers. But again, the surprising thing is not necessarily all that much. So if you're guessing strangers, between strangers on the same 20-item test, again, you actually do a little better than chance, because there's some stereotype knowledge in this. You get about 4 out of 20 right.
And so what is the takeaway from this study?
Well, I think the takeaway, I think there are a couple of takeaways. One is that you can do this. So even when we give you hard questions, you're better than chance. You do learn things about the mind of your spouse. And even if you haven't talked about these issues before, so even if you haven't talked about, you know, how concerned you are about your family's debt, or one of our other questions was, if I had my life to live over again, I sure would do things differently. Even if you haven't talked about your life's regrets, you can get some sense about that. So that's one of the take-home messages. You can do this. The other thing to take from this is that you probably aren't doing this as well as you think you are. And so some humility is really the key to enabling understanding between multiple people. Some recognition that there may be a lot more going on in the mind of another person than you think.
Yeah. And it also makes me wonder if I'm only a little bit better than chance in predicting my spouse's thoughts, how accurate am I in reading my boss's mind?
Yeah. Well, again, on these things, the question is how easy are the items? How easy is it to do the things you're trying to do? And this gets to the point I make in the last chapter of the book. It would be great if we had some secret tricks for understanding each other better. The bulk of the book is about why we misunderstand each other so routinely. What is it about our brains and our minds that leads us astray? But I think one of the take-home message of the whole thing is that if you recognize that you don't understand each other as well as you think you do, then the real key to understanding is asking the other person what they think. It would be great if I had a bunch of magic tricks for you, little tweaks and little things you could watch, and there are some of those. But it turns out that when our couples get this right, when our couples predict each other's responses really well, it's because we've put them in a condition where they can do that, and that condition is simple. Before predicting how your spouse is going to respond on the 7-point scale, we give them the questions, and we have them talk through them. That's it. Interestingly, that opportunity to get the other person's perspective, to actually hear from them directly, doesn't change your confidence. So they still think they're about just as good after they've heard the answers to the questions. But when you actually look at their performance, when you've talked through these items, when you've actually heard what's on the other person's mind through their mouth, that's when accuracy goes up dramatically. It just doesn't change our confidence in those cases.
We are talking with Nick Epley. He is the author of MindWise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want. And we are welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming any examples you might have of moments of perfect understanding or misunderstanding. We'll talk more about why we misunderstand when we come back. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about how we understand and what gets in the way of understanding each other. Talking with Nick Epley. He is a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. And he is the author of MindWise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Nick, let's talk a little bit. I wanted to get into the why we misunderstand, but talk some a little bit about why is it important to know about this? Oops, I'm sorry. I have the wrong button on, so now I'll ask you to start again.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So I think there are two real reasons why we think about the minds of others in the first place, and those two reasons explain why it matters. One is that understanding a person's motives or intentions allows us to explain their actions right now. So, you know, somebody could harm you on purpose or on accident, and the difference between those two is a big one. Somebody who harms you on purpose is likely to harm you again in the future. Somebody who harms you on accident is not. And so it's a critical for understanding why people do what they do right now. The other reason why thinking about another's thoughts and their emotions and their motives matters is because it allows them to predict what's going on down the road, what they're likely to do next. So we spend a lot of time in our lives, for instance, trying to convey the right kind of impression to other people, trying to make sure that others see us for who we are and understand our strengths and weaknesses, because we understand if they do that, if an employer recognizes our abilities, they're going to treat us better down the road. They're going to hire us. They're not going to fire us. It allows us to predict their behavior in the future. And when we get those things wrong, when we misunderstand each other, we make bad choices about other people. That's the fundamental reason why it's bad to misunderstand.
Yeah. Where is our ability to read minds most used and most important?
Where is it most used? Boy, that's a hard question, because it's a little like asking a doctor, where is breathing most important? Mm. You know, it's kind of everywhere. If you're stuck on a desert island as a hermit, then nothing in the book is going to matter to you. It matters anytime other people are around, because these kinds of inferences are happening all the time. It happens at work when you wonder whether your boss is going to appreciate the project report you just put together. Are they going to find it interesting? Are they going to understand it? Of course, it comes up in our marriages. We just had Valentine's Day last Friday. There were some gifts that were exchanged. Some were good gifts that were exchanged. Other people missed it and left their significant other feeling perhaps not as good as they could have. It obviously matters in any kind of relationship you have with somebody else. If you really understand each other well, you can manage that relationship better. And if you misunderstand somebody, you can't manage it well at all.
What is it that gets in the way of perfectly understanding another person?
Well, I think there are two things. First is, a little bit like breathing, I suppose, you can hold your breath and not use that ability. And the same thing is true with our social senses. You can try to engage with somebody else and really try to connect with them, really try to understand what's going on between their ears, or you can remain completely disengaged from the mind of another person. And so whether or not you engage this ability or not is one source of the problem. When you don't engage it, when you don't really connect with somebody else's thoughts, that can lead you to think that, it can really lead to indifference is what can happen. And you see this coming up in cases where people seem unable to empathize with somebody who they're very different from, they're not connected to, they haven't heard from directly. So the rich thinking about the poor, for instance, is one example, or thinking about what it's like to be tortured if you're trying to figure out whether waterboarding constitutes torture or not, or thinking about what it's like to be a parent when in fact you haven't been a parent. Those are hard gaps to bridge, and that requires engaging this ability. We don't always. The other thing that gets in the way is that once we're actually trying to think about the mind of another person, there are kind of three tools that we use, and each of those can lead to predictable mistakes. One is that we tend to use our own mind as a guide to another person, but other people think differently than we do. So extremes in a partisan debate, for instance, people who are really passionate about a political issue, for instance, tend to think that members of the other side are just as passionate as they are. They use their mind as a guide. Other people think differently than we do, and we can miss that. The other tool we use is that we tend to rely on stereotypes when making inferences about other people. So you know what group somebody belongs to. So when thinking about what the other side believes, for instance, in a political debate, you know if somebody is conservative or if they're liberal, you have some sense of what their beliefs are. And there is some accuracy in that. There is some average accuracy in that, but it tends to miss on individual predicting individuals and create some systematic errors. One of the biggest is that when groups are defined by their differences, the stereotypes we have about them, about the differences, say, between men and women or between members of opposing political sides, tends to exaggerate the differences between those groups. And then the last thing we use to understand the mind of another is we use their behavior. But behavior can sometimes be misleading.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Nick Epley. He is the author of MindWise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones. We have Martine in Milwaukee with us first. Hi, Martine. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Nick, I'm actually a graduate from the University of Chicago, always been fascinated about behavioral economics. I'm just curious if there's any analogies, any per se signals that, you know, we tend to read from the market, the stock market, and if there's any analogies that we can draw in terms of trying to estimate, you know, what the market is going to do, you know, if you will, the mind of the market, you know, how do we react to that?
So there are two. First off, glad to hear from an alum. Thanks, Martine. There are two points to make there. One point to make is that people tend to read too much into the minds of things that, in fact, aren't human. This is a phenomenon that we refer to as anthropomorphism, where you can, under certain circumstances, attribute a mind to something that arguably is actually mindless. And the market is one of those things. So people will talk about the mood of a market and what the market is thinking. And there's an example where I think we're using analogies to a human mind that in fact are misplaced. And it leads you, we find in some of our experiments, that it can lead you to think that market trends are going to be more stable than they actually are. So this is true about a person. If you know what their intentions are, if you know that somebody is intending to harm you, you will think that they will harm you next time. That is, it leads to a prediction of continuity between behavior. That's what happens when you attribute a mind to a market which arguably does not really have a mind, in instance of anthropomorphism. But Martine, as you remember from your time here at the University of Chicago, one of our Nobel Prize-winning economists, in fact, just won the Nobel Prize this year, Gene Fama, one of the things he pointed out and got his Nobel Prize for was just noting the inherent unpredictability of the market. It's not completely unpredictable, but reasoning about the mind of the market does not seem to make you markedly better. But one of the things that Gene also showed was that people tend to be rewarded on their performance, say in investment firms or in finance, tend to be rewarded on their performance in predicting stocks. Say, even though that seems to be more about chance than it does about skill. And I think that's a consequence of thinking that the market is, in fact, more mindful than it actually is. So is there anything to take from the mind of the market? According to my colleague Gene Fama, not really. That is, as he points out, it's hard to predict it at better than chance levels. And I'm not a finance person, so I will have to trust a Nobel Prize winner on this
one. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Martine, for the call. We'll move next to Shauna in Milwaukee. Hello, Shauna. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment and question is for the guest. I'm wondering why he hasn't talked about fiction and the interiority of fiction and how you can mind read other people through reading fiction. And I would suggest to your listeners and your guests that that's the best way of getting into other people's minds and trying to understand them and getting more empathy.
So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so there is some interesting work on what are the consequences of reading fiction for empathy and for engagement with the mind of another. And as the caller, as Shauna mentioned, the data do suggest some effect of reading fiction on at least trying to engage with the mind of another person. What I don't know of is any research that suggests that it inherently makes you more accurate understanding another person. So it allows us, it gives us stories into what it's like to be in a very different perspective than our own. And fiction, very nicely, usually gives you the backstory. It usually gives you text about what's going on inside the head of another person before they do that. Whether that actually makes you more accurate predicting what a spouse thinks or what your boss thinks of you, or what somebody in a position of poverty actually feels or believes depends on the accuracy of the fiction itself, and whether it does so broadly, we actually don't yet know from research. So there's some very interesting work being done on the consequences of reading fiction. How it plays out more broadly is yet to be determined. It's an empirical question, but lots of psychologists are working on it.
We do know, though, that stereotypes get broken down by fiction, and we also know that you can individualize people by reading fiction rather than stereotyping them.
No, that's true. But again, the question, it's a different question about whether reducing stereotyping inherently increases accuracy. It doesn't always. So if, for instance, I'm trying to predict what a conservative or a liberal thinks, I do get some information out of knowing that they're conservative or liberal. Now, I don't know necessarily what Jim or Jill thinks in particular, but I do get a little bit more accurate. The question would be, is removing that stereotype inherently increasing accuracy? Not necessarily. What does so is talking to Jim or Jill directly and getting their story, learning, putting them in a context where they can actually tell you what they think or believe. That will certainly do it. Whether fiction does so across the board, again, is an open empirical question.
You also discuss in the book that we are self-centered, and that causes us to assume others see and perceive more about us or what we're trying to say than they actually do. Talk more about this and what problems this can cause.
Yeah, so this is a real challenge in any kind of communication context. What I'm doing right now, for instance, is a textbook example of this. I'm trying to explain 200 pages of a book and two decades of research, well, more than that, by many colleagues of mine. And I know this research extremely well. I know it inside and out, every possible way you can think of it. I know all of the experiments I describe. And it can make it, for me, a challenge to communicate because it can make it seem like I'm communicating more clearly than I actually am. And this is true for all of us. So our last caller, Shauna, for instance, was describing what we know about reading fiction. She knows some things, perhaps that I do not, about what she was trying to communicate. And that can make it hard to communicate clearly for any of us because we tend to assume we're being more clear than we actually are.
Our next caller is Dee in Amory. Hello, Dee.
Hi. I'm really enthralled with this conversation because as far as reading what someone else is thinking, I almost years ago destroyed a very, very important relationship by assuming that she was thinking something that was absolutely not right. It was a friend that I'd had in relationship for many years. We were very close. We knew each other's ultimate secrets. And at one point, I went to her house to see her. And she came to the door, and she said to me, "I can't talk to you right now." And she closed the door on me. And I was just devastated. And all the way home, in my mind, I just crucified her. I was never going to speak to her again, and you better not ever call me in the middle of the night again, because I will not be there for you. And I was just horrible. And a few days later, she called me, and she said, "I knew I could do that because you're such a good friend, and you would understand." And I wasn't a good friend. I did not understand.
Did you make amends?
My feeling was that she was just cutting me off, and I just could not deal with that. And that wasn't the case at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was going on, Dee? She just had a crisis occurring, and she needed to deal with that, and couldn't talk to you.
She had something going on, and knowing her as well as I did, I surely have understood that. I really should have, because it wasn't the first time that we encountered situations like that with each other. But that particular instance, I just assumed what she was thinking was that I was not her friend anymore, and she didn't have time for me. And that was all in my head. It had nothing to do with reality.
Thank you for sharing that example, Dee. What's your reaction to that, Nick?
Well, it illustrates one of the other central challenges with understanding each other, and that is that behavior can be misleading. So here's a case where you've got dear friends coming over, one dear friend coming over to talk to the other. The person is essentially rejected at the door. At least that's the way it would be if a stranger did that to you, right? But that behavior, I can't talk to you right now, is hard to interpret. It's difficult. It could mean lots and lots of things. And it's easy to assume. So that's a reaction. I can't talk to you right now. I'm sorry you have to go away. If any random person did that to us, that would be a negative action. And so it's easy to assume, to jump to a conclusion, which, Dee, as she points out painfully, did in this case. It's easy to assume that a person's mind matches our immediate interpretation of the reaction that we see. So stupid is as stupid does, as sometimes the saying goes. You see somebody do something that doesn't seem so smart or seems negative or seems maybe even positive. You infer that the mind matches the action that you observe, but there's often a considerable amount of complication behind it. People can do things on accident or on reasons that you can't anticipate that creates a very complicated relationship between the behavior we observe in somebody and what they're actually thinking or feeling. And, the most painful moments, as Dee pointed out here, are cases where we really misread what's going on behind the mind of another person because we assume that it matches their actions much more than it actually does.
Dee, thank you so much for the call. Chris in Manitowoc says, it seems to me that this has nothing to do with being able to read minds, but simply a human's ability to read body language, emotion, past knowledge of a particular person. If the experiment for spouses was better than for strangers, it seems that the prior knowledge and experiences of the subject is what guides us.
Right. Yeah. So again, what we want to know is what makes us a little better than chance. And there are a number of things that do. This person mentioned body language. We certainly get some of that. We get some accuracy out of that, out of reading emotions and reading cues. But it turns out we get less than you might think from that. So when I was writing this book, lots of people asked me about body language. And the literature on it suggest that you do get some accuracy, so you can tell what a person is feeling by watching them closely and by reading their body language. But there's little research that suggests that learning how to do this better systematically makes people better across the board. And the main reason is that bodies can be misleading. You don't necessarily know. So we just got the call from Dee a second ago where her friend was going through some experience. She saw her body language there at the door and misread it. We can all conceal our true emotions with our body, and we may not be nearly as expressive as we think. And so body language, I actually think, is not a very good cue for understanding other people. I rode in on the train this morning, and there were, maybe 50 people in the train car I was sitting in. They were all feeling radically different things, but they were all sitting there stone-faced. Body language speaks, but it only whispers to us, not very strongly.
And you've also done some research regarding email versus phone and accuracy, and we are more accurate in understanding via telephone than we are by email?
Yeah, this again gets to the question about what actually gives us insight. And what gives us insight is actually communicating directly with somebody else in a way that gives as much information as we can. So the surprising thing, I think, about our email research wasn't that people were better communicating with their voice. You can communicate, much of what we communicate to somebody else comes through paralinguistic and other sorts of cues in our voice. What was interesting, so that's not surprising, we had people communicating sarcasm and sincerity, for instance, or different kinds of emotions. People do that partly with their voice, so they're better there than with email. The interesting thing was that the communicators didn't seem to have any sense of this at all. Email and other such text-based communication, of course, as we all know at kind of an abstract level, strips away much of the information that actually enables us to understand a statement. So when I tell you, for instance, that the weather in Chicago today is awesome, You don't know whether I'm being sincere or sarcastic on that if you just read it mm-hmm. in text. What allows you to disambiguate that is that some of the cues in my voice. Interesting in those studies for us was that the people who are communicating thought they had communicated just as clearly when they were using a horribly ambiguous medium like text than when they were communicating with a much more accurate medium like their voice. And that comes from knowing what you're trying to communicate. You know when I say that the weather in Chicago today is awesome, I know that I'm being sarcastic because just like for all your listeners, it's snowing here today too, and I've had enough of shoveling snow this winter. I know that I'm being sarcastic, but somebody who's in California who just reads that, mm-hmm. can't hear my voice, isn't going to know that. But because I know what I'm trying to communicate, it makes me think I'm communicating much more clearly than I actually am.
We are talking with Nicholas Epley. He is a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He is also the author of MindWise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want. And we welcome your questions for him. We welcome your thoughts, your examples. How well do you think you understand what others think? How do you do it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking about how we understand and how we misunderstand. We are talking with the author of MindWise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want, Nicholas Epley. And our next caller is Gloria in Lancaster. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a concern and a real misunderstanding, or I don't know if it's misunderstanding as much as it's not having empathy for other people. When we just as an example, when we talk about global warming, there are people that really don't think of other people and what it does to the earth. Just as an example, my concern is that the water be raised in the ocean another 2 degrees, and that can make a world of difference in the weather. As you can see, it's really tormenting the weather right now, global warming. And there are people, like they said on the radio the other day, that it's almost like the earth was flat, are the people that are denying about global warming. But they were thinking that people were thinking about a Greenland, which will eventually.
Gloria? I'm afraid we're getting into too much of the details of the climate change debate. Let me, because of limited time, frame the question this way, Nick. Why do people, in the face of science and facts and evidence that say one thing, decide they're going to believe another thing?
Well, I think there is. So first off, the science is never crystal clear, although in the case of climate change, this may be the one really shocking exception. So there's often some ambiguity that at least if you don't want to believe something, you can usually find some justification for it. Now, I share deep concerns about climate change, of course, as I think anyone who attends to the science does. But let's think about if you didn't. It's easy to assume or to question what on earth people on the other side of a debate like this could be thinking when you're not in that particular position. But notice that a debate like climate change is a hard one to deal with because it's really about what's really required is for you to think about and have empathy with and put yourself in the shoes of people who aren't here now. That is our future selves, ourselves when we're 60 or 70 or 80 years down the road, or future generations. And one of the things that's really hard about empathy or connection is connecting with the minds of people who aren't right here in front of you right now. So people save too little for retirement in part because they can't empathize when they're 30 years old with the mind of the person they will become when they're 65. They treat the mind of that 65-year-old like they would another person. And if somebody comes up to you on the street and says, you know, could you give me a couple dollars, often we're distant from them. No, we don't really want to do that. We treat our future selves the same way. Climate change is a bedeviling problem psychologically, even in the face of science, because it really requires us to empathize, to have a deep connection for, and to have a deep concern with minds that are not yet here, minds down the road that are 30, 50, 100 years down the road. And of course, they come sometimes, at least, as a cost to people who are standing right in front of our eyes. So you're having to trade off jobs now for jobs in the future, or comfort now for comfort in the future. Those are hard things for our brains to handle well. And I think you see a case here where we're probably not handling it that well.
Thank you so much, Gloria. You also talk about how assumptions and mind reading can increase divides in politics and in other areas of our lives. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, certainly I think anyone from the state of Wisconsin knows about political divides over the last few years. One of the interesting questions that you can ask is whether partisans in disputes really understand the other side and the issue. Certainly they understand some aspects of the other side's issue, but one of the findings, and this comes again from egocentrism, is that is that bigger than the actual problems of polarization between political sides is assumed polarization. That is, tending to assume that the other side in a debate is more extreme than it actually is. That, for instance, it's opposed to you on the very central aspect of the issue that you hold most dear, when in fact the other side is actually just thinking about the issue in a different way than you are. Or assuming that the other side has just more extreme views than the other side actually does. What you then end up doing, as I think everybody sees going on right now in Washington, D.C., but also at state levels, are people fighting arguments with another side that doesn't really quite exist. That instead of fighting more between actual ideas and issues, they're imagining an extreme side, and a side that's more extreme than it actually is. It's hard to negotiate when those are the assumptions you're making about the other side.
Our next caller is Gareth in Maguanago. Hi, Gareth, you're on the air.
Good morning. I have noticed that one of the things that gets in the way of my ability to read minds is my either desire or fear about what the other person is thinking. You know, if I fear that they might be thinking something and I see a look on their face, I will think that they're thinking about that. They might be thinking about something entirely different. Have you done any research into the emotional desires or fears of the mind reader and their effect on accuracy?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most liberating set of experiments, Gareth, that I've ever conducted in my life or been involved with, one that's really changed my life, was some work that we did in graduate school, when I was in graduate school with my advisor, Tom Gilovich at Cornell. And what we did was we had people do things that were rather embarrassing in front of an audience. So we'd ask you to sing the Star Spangled Banner, for instance, while chewing on bubble gum, or dance the bossa nova in front of an audience. Or we'd put you in a situation where we asked you a bunch of really hard questions that you couldn't answer very well. So we put you in the very same kind of state of fear that you were mentioning right there. We had people who were embarrassed. And then we asked them to predict how they were being judged by other people. And one of the things that we found was that people consistently, when they were embarrassed about themselves, tended to overestimate how harshly they were judged by other people. Other people cut them more slack than they thought. And that's an example, I think, of egocentrism there, that when you're embarrassed about something, you think you've just done something that looks idiotic, you can assume that others are thinking worse of you than they actually are. The other part of your question, though, Gareth, which was really interesting, was that you mentioned that a fear of understanding somebody else's thoughts can get in the way of really understanding them, and that's absolutely right. So in performance appraisals, for instance, we do a demonstration in my class with my MBA students where we have people on opposing sides of a performance appraisal talk for about half an hour about the issues that are going on, and then we ask them to predict the other side's evaluations of them. And one of the real barriers in performance appraisals, particularly for the person who's being evaluated, is fear that the other side isn't thinking well of them. And that's a barrier because then you don't ask the other person in a way that's open and honest what they're actually thinking of you in a way that allows them to tell you. And if you are afraid of that in a way that keeps you from asking questions that would allow another person to tell you openly and honestly, you're not going to hear it from them. When I was writing this book, I was very worried that people would judge it negatively or misunderstand it. And so when I gave it to my PhD students and other colleagues to read it, I told them the only thing that I wanted to hear was stuff that would make it better. Tell me the things that are bad. That hurt me, of course. That didn't feel good. But I had to be open to that negative information in order for me to really understand, because that's the information that they wouldn't have told me otherwise. So two interesting points there. Thanks so much for that question, Gareth.
Thank you, Gareth. Fred in Palmyra is with us now. Hi, Fred.
Hey, good morning. I heard earlier in the show, I missed some of it, I'm sorry, but I heard earlier in the show where married couples were predicting the behavior of the spouse. Has your guest done any research on mothers predicting the behavior of their children?
I think it was getting into intuition, a mother's intuition or a woman's intuition.
Yeah. So I haven't done research on mothers and their kids specifically, although I think that would be very fascinating. And if there's a bigger gulf between the mind of a teenager and the mind of than the mind of an adult, I don't know what gulf that is. But we certainly do know a lot about things like women's intuition and gender differences in sensitivity to other people. And your stereotypes about this are right, at least roughly speaking. So it does turn out that women are a little better than men at predicting another person's emotion, for instance, just from seeing their facial expression. They are a little bit better at predicting, for instance, what their spouse thinks along these attitude issues. They pay a little bit more attention to other people than men do. But what we also find in our experiments is that if you ask men and women to predict the size of this gender difference, that is, you ask them on this test, for instance, of emotional intelligence, you're trying to predict what somebody else is feeling just from seeing an expression, it's just from seeing their facial expression, that people think the gender difference is much, much bigger than it actually is. So if you're statistically inclined, the effect size calculations in this case would range from 0 to 1, with 0 being no effect, no difference at all between men and women, and 1 being, an enormous difference. They can get bigger than that, but we'll just use that scale for now. The effect size that we get is bigger than 0. It's about 0.2. That's a relatively small statistical effect, but people think the effect size is more in the 0.7 or 0.8 range. That is, they tend to overestimate it by 2 or 3 times.
We have less than 30 seconds, Nick, so we should ask people what they're thinking and not just assume.
I wish there was a magic trick. There's not. The data suggests it's clear. Understanding a person's mind comes through their mouth.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicholas Epley is author of MindWise, How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.